Well, what's going on in Boston Bruins news? We have the Bees beating the Minnesota Wild today in an afternoon matinee at the Xcel Energy Center in St. Paul by a score of 4-2. The game was significant in that it represented the second win in a row this week for the Bruins after beating Winnipeg earlier 6-2, and then that followed on the heels, of course, of the disaster at the TD Garden, 9-2 loss to the Los Angeles Kings. However, this was a good victory for the Bees. Backup Jonas Gustafsson played well in net, made some key stops. Brad Marchand continued his torrid pace, scoring his 27th goal of the year, fourth shorthanded marker when he tipped home a David Krejci pass. David Krejci himself scored a nice goal off of a give-and-go by banking it into the net off of Nino Niederreiter. And Louis Eriksson was sent away on a breakaway and by Ryan Spooner and scored his 18th goal of the season, 200th for his career. Zdeno Chara closed out the scoring with an empty netter. And the Minnesota Wild fired head coach Mike Yeo, who was the toast of the town last year, last season getting the Wild into the playoffs, got some great goaltending from Devan Dubnyk. This year just went off the rails for him, and it really goes to show you how tenuous a head coaching job can be. The game was significant also in the coaching circles from the Boston standpoint in that Claude Julien registered his 500th career victory, and he continues to march closer to Art Ross for number one all-time on the Boston coaching victories ladder. I think he's got about six to go to tie Art Ross, and when he reaches his 387th victory, he'll be even with the longtime Boston Bruins coach and general manager for which the league's MVP trophy is named for. So the Bruins got a big victory, and we'll see how they do tomorrow when they take on the Detroit Red Wings in Detroit as their road trip continues. Now, this podcast is exciting for me because I'm taking a bit of a departure and doing something different. You may recall over the summer when the blog began in July during the off-season, I was doing a series of Twitter mailbags where I would solicit questions about hockey, prospects, Bruins, the draft, you name it, even pop culture. And then I would answer them on my blog and post it. Now, in the interest of doing things a little differently and changing it up, I solicited questions a few days ago and got quite a few. Thank you to all those who submitted. Not going to have time to get to all of them, but I think I'm going to be able to answer a pretty, you know, substantial amount here, and I'm looking forward to it. And that way you don't have to get on the blog and scroll down and hurt your eyes, reading my responses, but you can just listen to them at your convenience and leisure. So with that in mind, we're just going to go ahead and jump into it. The first question came from Jacob Bench on February 11th, and Jacob asked, are there any young D-men who are real possibilities to be acquired by the Bruins? What would it take to get Jacob Trouba? That's a good question, Jacob. Basically, I think the Bruins are like any other NHL team right now that is looking for a young defenseman, and that they're going to be hard-pressed to make that happen. Off the top of my head, I can't really talk through any real possibilities because the reality is that with teams hitting the stretch drive of the regular season and a lot of parity in the league, so many teams are still vying for playoff spots. That makes it extremely difficult to go out and trade for such an important asset to any NHL roster, which is a young, higher-end caliber defenseman who is on a lower cost contract because of their age, but shows a lot of potential and shall we say that a ubiquitous word, upside, for the future. Now, certainly Jacob Trouba constitutes as such a commodity, and there have been rumors out of Winnipeg that he's unhappy with the situation. Perhaps you could liken it a bit to Dougie Hamilton, where he's maybe seeing the writing on the wall, or maybe would like to get a fresh start elsewhere. And the thing, though, with the Jets and general manager Kevin Cheveldayoff is they're under no sense of urgency to trade Trouba because they own his rights in perpetuity. He would be a restricted free agent when his entry-level deal expires here in the summer. And so they can just kind of hold on to them and see where it leads. Now, if Chevy were to fear an offer sheet, perhaps, then that's a bridge that the Jets would have to cross at some point. But realistically, I don't know that we will see Trouba dealt at the deadline, just because he's a impressive specimen, still growing and developing and coming into his own. I think it's been a little disappointing in terms of his development is kind of stalled, whereas a few years ago when he came in as a rookie, it really looked like the sky was going to be the limit for him. He was certainly an outstanding prospect coming out of the national team program, and then the University of Michigan won a gold medal with the USA World Junior team in 2013, and then really showed signs of being a bell cow, number one cornerstone-type defenseman in his rookie year with the Jets. And kind of took steps backwards last year, and this year hasn't really been able to get it back on track, so to speak. But Trouba's one of these name players. He hasn't, you know, built a really impressive resume, so to speak, but he's still kind of living off of his draft potential and the buzz that he generated when he was a real dominant college defenseman for a year. And I don't know, a guy like Trouba is going to be a little bit of a risky proposition. And I'm afraid that what it would take to get him when the Bruins, if the Bruins were to engage the Jets, would be someone like a David Pastrnak would probably be a starting point for Cheveldayoff off in the Jets. And I think you're kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul at that point. So certainly if the deal would be right for someone like Trouba, the Bruins would be right to pursue it. But I'm not sure that, trying to dangle the first-round picks would be all that enticing because of where those picks are currently slotted. The Jets would want to have a shot if they're going to trade a Jacob Trouba. They would want draft picks that are going to net them the potential to pick a Jacob Chychrun, for example, someone who could potentially replace the talent that they're potentially giving up by moving Trouba to another team. And that's a tough sell, and it's a challenge. And like I said, at this stage, the Jets are don't have their backs to the wall. He's under contract, he's playing, and they could potentially ride it out. And then, as the Bruins did last summer, maybe make a move around the draft or over the summer if Trouba makes it clear that he wants to move on. So, good question to close it back up. I don't really know who else the Bruins might target. And realistically, it's going to be tough to make a big splash at the deadline just because there are so many other teams that are looking to get better, but not a lot of teams that are completely out of the playoff mix and looking to sell off assets like that. Next question I'm getting is coming from Hellblazer Vice, TSN The Rock. He is a Devils supporter. Met him in Toronto for the 2011 Combine. I hope you're doing well. Enjoyed seeing you there, and maybe our paths will cross again at some point. But his question to me is, it says, you have seen a lot of Sioux games, so I'm curious to hear your thoughts on Blake Spears and Colton White. Well, you're right. They are currently teammates of Zach Senyshyn of the Sault Ste. Marie Greyhounds of the Ontario Hockey League, and both Devils prospects. And I like Spears. He is a table setter type of playmaking center. Has got a lot of ability, and he got off to a tough start offensively and statistically speaking, but he's really picked it up. He's leading the Greyhounds in points, gets more assists than he does goals. But he and Senyshyn see a lot of time together, and certainly on the power play. And they Spears is largely responsible for setting the table a good bit for Senyshyn, and that's good to see. I think he's certainly developing on the right track, and he's going to be someone who's going to need a little time probably in junior and in the minors to continue to hone his 200-foot game and get a little bigger and stronger and ready to handle the rigors of pro hockey in the National Hockey League. But I like his vision and his hockey IQ on the offensive side of things. And he's just got a nice touch with the puck, and he's able to thread the needle. So I think he's a solid pickup for the Devils. Colton White's interesting. He's kind of a feast or famine type player at times, a real talented defenseman who kind of carries the modern attributes you're looking for in terms of skating. And he's good in puck retrieval and has the ability to provide some offense from the back line. But sometimes I think his decision-making is suspect. He seems to, at times, struggle with reading and reacting and activating at the right time. He'll get caught pinching and out of position. And I've seen, you know, on multiple occasions where he'll maybe press a little too much and then give up an odd man rush the other way. So I think Colton White is going to be one of these guys that has some boom potential, but he's going to have to be carefully coached and managed and developed. He's not someone who's going to come in right away and make a big splash and play a refined, polished game at the pro level. He's probably going to have to play out the string in junior and then work his way up the ladder in the minors. But certainly, one of those players that might be worth the risk and the wait if he can deliver on his potential. So I hope that covers it for you. And those are two interesting players, both teammates of Zach Senishin, Bruins prospect of note. Next question is from Mike DeFonso, also on February 11th. It says, what do you think the forward lines will look like next year? Do you think anyone will be moving up from Providence, and will Louis stay? Well, when it comes to forward lines, I mean, we're in February 2016. We still have the rest of the regular season, potentially the playoffs, and then we've got next off season and summer to watch the roster take shape. So I don't really think I'm going to speculate too much on what the forward lines will look like next year. There's going to be some obvious changes at some point. So I'll address the big part of your question where you say, will Louis stay? I think the answer is no. I do not see Louis Erickson being on the Bruins past the trade deadline. I do believe that they will move him, and that's no indictment on Louis or his play. He's having a very good season. He's been an excellent player and teammate since he came over in the trade for Dallas. Unfortunately for Louis, I think his legacy will always kind of carry that burden of the fact that he was dealt for Tyler Seguin, and he was the most visible NHL asset coming back in that deal. And because Tyler Seguin has evolved into this NHL superstar and one of the top scorers in the league, that's going to reflect poorly kind of when fans think of Louis Erickson. He's going to kind of have to pay the price a little bit, but he's certainly been a model citizen, a really good teammate. He's a smart player, a Bruins type of player. He's dependable in all zones. He does the little things, goes to the net, finds ways to make things happen. He's pretty consistent scorer. He's just not a high-end, flashy, dynamic guy the way Seguin is. And so that's just the bottom line. Unfortunately for the Bruins, Erickson will be 31 at the end of this season, and he's looking to cash in on one last nice contract before he calls it a career, essentially. And so I don't think he's going to be all that interested in taking a hometown discount or signing for less term and lower money to do the Bruins a favor. So they're going to be faced with a hard decision, I think, of having to move him to get what they can. And I'm not sure what they'll get for him. He's a veteran guy, and so a Stanley Cup contending team would certainly want to add him, but they're not going to want to trade anything back to Boston on their NHL roster in a deal involving Erickson. He's the kind of player that you add to your existing contending roster in hopes that he puts you over the top. You don't give a big piece back. So I think, you know, Boston will be fortunate to get maybe a first round pick for him, or maybe a solid prospect that, you know, along the lines of a Colin Miller, maybe a little better than a Colin Miller. It's hard to say, but I think if fans are expecting that Louis is gonna bring back a young defenseman in return with that upside to make the Boston Bruins blue line better for the long run, they'll be a little disappointed. As far as people moving up from Providence, I mean, I think Frank Vetrano, we will probably see Frank Vetrano again in Boston. Certainly if Louis is traded, I would expect the Bruins will look at either bringing Vetrano or maybe Seth Griffith up. And by next year, I've got to think Vetrano will be vying for a spot on the Boston Bruins roster. He's a kid that just has demonstrated that he has that wicked shot. It's an NHL caliber shot. He scored a hat trick against Pittsburgh. I mean, the consistent offense wasn't there at the NHL level, but boy, he's been torching the AHL with 20 goals in 18 games and doesn't show any signs of stopping there. So he's an exciting player, and I think for sure we will see him again at some point. So thanks for that question, Mike. And I move on to the next query from Steve-O Mac. Steve-O said, should the Bruins have taken Colin White with one of their picks last year? Well, that's kind of the question of the hour of late. I know that Pierre Maguire has been talking pretty steadily about that since Zach Sinishin was taken 15th overall on the broadcast on draft night. Colin White is a tremendous prospect. Looks like the Senators hit it out of the park in getting him 21st overall with the second of two picks. He wasn't even their top pick. They took Thomas Chabot, defenseman, and out of St. John, and then took White with the second of two first-rounders. And I just can't say enough about Colin White. I've been watching him play for quite a few years now, going back to his time with Nobles, and then he went out to the national team. Unfortunately for Colin, last year he suffered one of those setbacks during the draft season. It's the dreaded scoring slump, where you take a player who was coming into the season considered to be a potential top 10 caliber player because he had been lighting it up like nobody's business the year before on the under 17 team out in Ann Arbor. And then the pucks just kind of quit going in for him, and he was having trouble generating consistent offense. And what I ended up hearing from multiple NHL scouts during the course of the year was, well, he's got the size, he's got the skating, he's got the hockey sense. We know he's going to play in the NHL at some point. And the question is he going to be a scorer? And that was what people were not too sure about, given that he was just kind of snake bit and wasn't producing much in the way of offense, on the national team a year ago. Of course, what a difference a year makes. He ends up, going 21st, goes off to BC, and now he's leading the team in scoring and doing very, very well as a freshman. So it's easy to say, yeah, the Bruins should have taken Colin White. I can tell you that they certainly thought about it. He was a player on their radar. I know several of their scouts probably that really had time for Colin White, and it was a tough decision to not take him. And in hindsight, we could certainly say, he probably would have been any one of those picks. He probably would have been a solid choice there, whether you think they should have taken him instead of Zach Sinishin or maybe Jake DeBrusque, Jakob Zboril. I mean, we can play a number of scenarios and go over it and question it, but ultimately, we're really not going to know for sure until the Bruins prospects either make it or don't, and then Colin White either makes it or doesn't. But I think he's got a world of talent, comes from excellent athletic stock. Both parents were high-end college athletes, although not in hockey. But he's just one of these players that can kind of do it all for you. And the Eagles are definitely reaping the benefits. So, I mean, should they have taken him? Maybe. Sure, I think you can argue it either way. But I don't think we'll be able to truly know for certain until we see him get to the pros and see, who turns out and in what regard. So, appreciate that. Next question is from Nabil RV Hockey. He asks, will Kevin Miller, Morrow, and or Trotman be moved to unclog the D, assuming Louis or someone is moved for an upgrade? Well, the interesting thing is, the Bruins certainly right now seem to have, a quantity of defensemen, but they're kind of lacking in the quality department in terms of not having these higher-end, big-minute-munching guys that can minimize the mistakes and go out and execute solid defensively and contribute offense from the back end. That's what's kind of gotten them into trouble and why the team has had trouble generating consistency in terms of winning hockey games. But I think it's dangerous to look at it, and I don't believe that the NHL club looks at it at trading players from the perspective of unclogging the D. Because, the moment you start moving guys just to create a little breathing room, that's when, Murphy's Law jumps on you and guys start getting injured and unforeseen things happen. And before you know it, what was a position that had some pretty good depth all of a sudden is very thin, and then you're forced to bring up guys that just are not ready for prime time at all, players you weren't planning on using at all because your depth, the serviceable but not necessarily, you know, higher end capable guys are gone. They've been moved out. So if we see a trade, I think I would be leery that the Bruins are going to be trading just to try to create space and opportunity. You'd certainly like to see Colin Miller get more of a consistent chance to go out. I've been impressed with what we've seen from Joe Morrow of late. I mean, you can really see the way he can skate and move that puck. You saw it today. When he gets those wheels revved up in the, you know, in his own end and cranks it up in the neutral zone, he can really gain the blue line. And one of the things we saw from the Wild all day, and I know Andy Brickley alluded to it, was the Wild was really just giving up their blue line and allowing the Bruins to just kind of walk in. We certainly don't see that very often. And a lot of times for the Bruins, it has been a struggle for them to gain the offensive blue line because a lot of times teams are aggressively disrupting them or standing them up at the blue line. But certainly today, and in Joe Morrow's case, we saw him just really be able to put the Wild back on their heels a bit with his speed. And we would certainly like to see more of that. So I'm intrigued by Morrow. I don't think he's going to be the high-end potential guy, you know, top two, top three that I thought he would be at one time when he was a first-round pick in 2011. But I do think he's an NHL talent, and I'd like to see the Bruins utilize him more, and it would be a shame to see him traded just because, and then watch him, you know, develop into a solid 4 or 5 and power play specialist somewhere else, because the Bruins can certainly use his wheels, and I would like to see Colin Miller as well. But I also understand that with Adam McQuaid out, it's tougher. The Bruins need a little more of a heavier, snarly, physical defenseman in the lineup. And Kevin Miller seems to be that guy, right, wrong, or indifferent. So I know, much to the chagrin of a lot of fans, because he does, when he's making errors, they seem to be glaring ones and costly at that. But for now, I think if the Bruins are going to make a trade, it won't be to unclog the D, but because they think that they can upgrade the group by trading those individuals depending on what assets they're getting back. So thank you for that. I appreciate the question. Another question comes in from David R. 1982. He asks about 2016 eligible defenseman Jacob Chychrun. Now, I talked at length about Jacob on my draft podcast. If you haven't heard that, go on to the blog, Scouting Post, and click on the podcasts section, and you can listen to about a 20 to 25-minute edition where I talk about some of the top draft options. So I won't go into detail about Jacob Chychrun's game, but the question is that Chychrun seems to be dropping a bit. Is it his play, or are other guys just pulling ahead? I think it's, you know, it's probably a little of both. Unfortunately for guys like Jacob Chychrun, he came into the season expected to be the number two overall pick behind Austin Matthews. And when you come in the bar is so high already, a lot of times, I mean, there's only one spot you can move up when you're in his situation, just one. But you can drop quite a bit. And I don't think he's been playing poorly as much as he's just the more scouts get a chance to see him. And given the role he's playing in Sarnia and the amount of minutes he's racking up and the expectations, it's easy to kind of nitpick and say, well, you know, he made a mistake here, or he didn't do this right, or, you know, on one play the other night, he was coming across the blue line trying to line up Zach Sinishin, and he lost an edge and went tumbling down. And then Sinishin made a great cutback move to just walk around him as he's sliding down on the ice, went in alone, and scored the highlight reel goal. You know, if you just look at that play in a vacuum, you say, well, what's all the hype about? But I just look at how well Chychrun skates and how well he moves the puck and how dangerous he is offensively. And he seems to be capable, positionally savvy, smart, three-zone defender. And so I think he'll be fine. I do think it's a matter of other guys pulling ahead. I mean, who knew that Patrick Laine and Jesse Puljujarvi were going to have such tremendous World Junior Championship tournaments? Matthew Tkachuk has been just a beast in the OHL this year. Certainly had another strong showing at the World Juniors as well. Other players are just kind of, it's a matter of players rising, you know, and not as much as Chychrun underperforming. But I go back to what I said originally, and that, you know, scouts just have a tendency to, you know, when they're looking at guys who start the season so high up, you have to perform at such a high level to stay there. And you know, so I think it's a matter of multiple factors, and I think he'll be fine. And boy, if the Bruins could somehow figure out how to get Jacob Chychrun, I think you've really addressed potentially a long-term solution at that position. But where they are right now, they'll have no shot at him. I can assure you that they're going to have to either they or the San Jose Sharks would have to crater. They'd have to get lucky in the lottery draw to get. To get up inside the top five, and then maybe even dangle some assets. So it'll be interesting to see where Chychrun goes. I don't think he'll fall very far at all, just because defensemen with his type of skill and potential high ceiling are in such demand. He won't be on the board long. So thanks for that. Mike Zavoda, ZTS65, asks, did you get a sense last June why the Bees passed on Kyle Connor three times, parentheses? Seems like he has shot past DeBrusque and Zboril this year. Well, yeah, I mean, I was personally a Kyle Connor guy. People might remember I did a mock draft with Low Tide out of Edmonton, and I represented the Bruins picking 14th at the time, and he was on the board, and I took him there. You're talking about a player who is just a high-end, dynamic scoring center, led the USHL in scoring with Youngstown a year ago, so he had a very high pedigree, and the Bruins passed on him. And I don't know for sure why. It's one of those things where I've never really pressed for a direct answer, but to my understanding, it had a lot to do with, Kyle's overall game was not as refined. He's not what you would call a Boston Bruins type player. Although certainly, I think in hindsight, when you look at how much he's dominating in the NCAA this year, you could make a good argument that if they could do it all over again, they probably would have made him one of the picks. But I don't know for sure. What I do know is that Jakub Zboril got off to a tough start, but he's playing better. And, he was the defenseman that everyone really felt that the Bruins needed to get. And so Zboril was their guy at 14, I think, no matter what. So then it comes down to DeBrusque and it comes down to Sinishin. And, whether you're talking Matthew Barzal or Kyle Connor, I mean, those guys are having outstanding seasons in their own right. But I think it would be selling Jake DeBrusque short to think that it was not worth it. In terms of where the Bruins took him, he scored 42 goals a year ago. And while his numbers are not going to match that goal scoring wise, he's certainly showing and playing more of a complete game, more attention to detail on defense. And I think DeBrusque has kind of gotten the short shrift here in terms of how he's viewed. He's playing well, and he's done well with Red Deer since his trade late last month, producing at more than a point per game pace. And I like Jake DeBrusque. So, I mean, it's like I said with the Colin White thing with Kyle Connor, we're just going to have to see what kind of a player he develops into. But boy, he sure looks like a superstar in the making. And the Jets, man, it's not tough to figure out, why the Jets pounced on him right away when he was available at their spot at 17 when their turn came. So more power to him and, good luck. But ultimately, the Bruins didn't take him. So I think, at some point we have to move on. Next question is from Tom F. He says, what do you see Connolly's ceiling as, and can he become a consistent 20 to 25 goal scorer? What's limiting him right now? Well, the ceiling is, second line right wing. That's the ceiling. He certainly has shown in flashes that he could do that. He has the skating, the shot. He has the tools to be a top six forward in this game. And certainly on the power play with the added time and space, he can make things happen. But the question is the second part of your query, which is, can he become a consistent 20-25 goal scorer? I think he can, but he's obviously not there right now. And I'm not sure what the problem is, whether it's more mental where he's gripping the stick tight or where it's just straight up hockey sense and the creativity that we thought maybe he had coming out of junior when he was such a prolific scorer for Prince George of the Western Hockey League, but it just hasn't come to fruition. Now, he did score 30 goals in the AHL, so it's not like he forgot what to do. I think it might be a confidence thing, and he's been bounced around on lines, and he's been healthy scratch a few times, and in some cases, guys just kind of get to gripping the stick too tight, and they put a lot of pressure on themselves because they just feel like they've just got to do it. They've got to do everything all at once, and maybe it's just a matter of simply refining his game and getting back to basics and just working on the small things, and he'll get there. But it's hard to say. You know, the NHL draft is the history throughout the years is full of guys like Brett Connolly who were taken high and never delivered on that promise. And it's certainly frustrating, and I can understand why Bruins fans are really disappointed, given that the team gave up 2 second-round picks, one last year and one this year, to get him, and then to see the level of production that he's brought, which hasn't been that good. But you know, for now, all they can do is keep rolling with him, and you know, we saw 3 assists from him the other night against Winnipeg. Which was a career best for him. So, I mean, we've seen it in flashes, but the consistency is the biggest thing. He goes long stretches to where he just doesn't do too much, and there are times where he'll just make plays that are, you look at it and it looks like he has tunnel vision and he doesn't see the ice very well and just isn't able to create. And then other times, you know, he'll surprise you a little bit with what he does pull off. So he's a big enigma and a mystery man, but the clock's ticking. And I will say this, if the Bruins do move on from him at some point, I don't think Boston will be his last stop in the NHL. Someone else will be willing to give him a chance in hopes of getting that sixth overall, something out of that sixth overall pedigree. But, you know, if he doesn't start showing something soon, then I think his time will be short. Next, questions from Davrion. Should the Bees make room for Vetrano? Is AHL stint helping his game? Should they make room for Vetrano? I think at this stage, no. You know, he came up, he had an opportunity to play in Boston, showed some great things at times, but he also showed that, you know, he wasn't in a situation where he was getting the kind of ice time that would be conducive to producing regularly. And ultimately, they optioned him back, and he's just been on a tear. I mean, the guy's done nothing but score goals in the AHL since he got there. He's had several hat tricks. We're talking 20 goals in 18 games, which is just an otherworldly pace when you compare him to the leading goal scorers around the league. You know, at that level, you know, he's right off their pace. I think the leading scorer had like 23 or 24 goals, but you're talking, you know, 50 games, you know, 48 games worth. And here he is sitting at 18. So I think the AHL is good for him. And he's playing a lot of minutes. He's playing power play. He's playing the penalty kill. He's getting to do things that he wouldn't otherwise get to do in Boston, because ultimately the coaches have not decided to put him in those same types of minute situations. And you know, in fairness, there are some players that you could make the argument that he should be maybe given an opportunity ahead of. And then there are others that absolutely not. So I think as a matter of making room for him, they don't need to make room for him. I think ultimately if Louis traded, you could see Vetrano come back to take that right side spot. Maybe they option it to Seth Griffith, who's another guy who's having a great scoring tear in the AHL right now. But ultimately, I think Vetrano's real time is going to come next year, and he'll, you know, assuming that he's still clicking along, he's shown a lot of hustle, attitude, moxie. That shot is just sublime. I mean, just the way he can get it off and find the back of the net from just about anywhere on the ice. And he just loves to be a Boston Bruin. I mean, it's his dream. I mean, we saw Justin Bailey the other night, who grew up around the Buffalo Sabres, make his NHL debut. And, you know, congratulations. I mean, you love to see these kids that get an opportunity to play for the team they always dreamed of when they were skating around as kids and imagining they're with the Bruins or the Sabres. And that's Vetrano, you know, Western Mass kid. And just came up like and he's risen like a meteor. But just because he's done well doesn't mean he has to be here now. And I think that's that shiny new toy syndrome. And sometimes there's something to be said about slowing down the developmental curve a little bit and letting these guys percolate. So, again, I appreciate that. Vetrano is certainly a hot topic these days, and he should be. It's hard to believe the Bruins signed him as a free agent, and it hasn't even been a year yet, and he's just had a huge impact on the organization. So full marks to the to Vetrano for reinventing himself and cutting the weight and coming to camp committed this year, and full marks to the Bruins and their scouts for seeing an opportunity and grabbing a player that was snubbed and overlooked since he was first draft eligible in 2012. Next question is from Matt D. Captain Bubba. He's a fellow Bruins blogger, thoughtful guy. We have some good conversations on Twitter from time to time, and he says, B's going to likely dangle a prospect or two to make an impact on 229. Please name your mostly untouchable from the AHL and below. Okay, so yeah, I think they will dangle a prospect or two. The question is, will the trade efforts pay off? Will they get the kind of value they need and they want? That's anyone's guess at this point. I know last year we were sitting there at the trade deadline and we're all kind of a little disappointed at what the Bruins came away with. They did get Brett Connolly, who promptly went out with a broken finger in his very first practice, and Max Talbot. But that's kind of the reality. What we have to remember is when you have so much parity in the league and there are so many teams that are fighting for playoff spots, you don't have a lot of sellers. So those limited sellers are able to drive the prices up. And when you're dealing with more veteran type guys who can dictate where they're going, some of those guys are less inclined to take a deal to Boston, because Boston's kind of middle of the pack. They want to go to a contender. That's the whole purpose of why they're agreeing to let their teams move them or want to be moved from those situations, because they want to contend. So a lot of times it's easier said than done. As far as untouchables, I think Vetrano, unless a team was offering you your young stud defenseman and it was a legitimate, not just a fringe, interesting, intriguing kind of guy, but a no joke, this guy is going to be something, in the NHL, and it's self-evident. I think you hold on to a Frank Vetrano and you don't want to move him unless you're getting the absolute right deal. Certainly, I think beyond him, there aren't too many people in Providence that at this stage that I'm sitting there saying to myself, yeah, they're not untouchable. I think most of the guys are on the table that down there. They're quality prospects. Seth Griffith is certainly playing well, but the question is, can he score like he's doing in the AHL at the NHL level? That's a question mark, and he's had a hard time kind of establishing himself, in Boston. And Kolachev, obviously, they've attempted to trade him before, so I see no reason why they wouldn't again. Now, down in the amateur ranks, I think some of your untouchable guys are players like Zach Sinishin. Maybe Danton Heinen has played so well for Denver this year. Maybe Jacob Forsbacka Carlson, the Bruins would want to hold on to, and Jesse Gabriel. Those are the guys that kind of come to mind. Possibly Jeremy Lazon. He's been very, he's been a pleasant surprise. But at the same time, it all comes down to the right deal and value. You can like your prospects all you want, but they're prospects. If a team is willing to trade you a proven commodity, and you think that this NHL player you're getting from the other guy is going to help your team, you look at doing it. But I think in terms of the guys that are really going to be attractive to other teams, you're talking about Vetrano, you're talking about Heinen, you're talking about Sinishin. Those are the guys that when Don Sweeney's picking up the phone to call, teams will be asking about those guys. And so you don't want to just make trades for the sake of making them and involving those players. So appreciate the question, Matt. Next one is from Adam O'Terry. He says, unlikely as it may be this season, do you see Boston asking 46 to waive in a deal involving a Petrangelo type? Yeah, I got to say no. I don't see that happening at all. Number one, the thing about Petrangelo, and I know you're not necessarily speaking directly about him, but there just aren't many Alex Petrangelos running around, and that's the problem. And he's injured, which means Kevin Shattenkirk now is likely completely off the table, because St. Louis is in win-now mode. So they're not going to want to deal a Kevin Shattenkirk, because if Petrangelo falls off the timetable or is not available, the Blues put themselves in jeopardy. So I see Shattenkirk being probably moved over the summer. It's not going to happen this season. Asking 46 I think he's got a no movement, so I don't even think they can. I would have to research that, and I probably should have before I started in to answer the question. But I just, given what David Krejci means for this team, They're not going to trade him midseason like this, and I can't imagine a team would really be hyped up to get him. I mean, he's you know, coming off of a recent injury, and he's cooled off considerably. So I just don't see it happening, Adam. But thanks for the question, CJ, and another tweeter named Stacy, who's very nice and has engaged me on Twitter with questions quite a few times. Are both interested in Sean Corrali. So I'll read CJ's question. He says, thoughts on Sean Corrali's potential as a pro? Seems like a beast type of guy. Numbers were down from last year. Any obvious reason? Well, yeah, I think he's a bottom six guy all the way. This is a kind of a grinder, third liner, maybe fourth line player, plays a heavy game, good size. He has never been one of these high-end offensive point producing players, even at the lower levels. I mean, he did have a good year in the USHL before he went to Miami, but he was a little older and had a year under his belt. Last year as a junior, scored 19 goals, and we're kind of hoping, well, maybe he'll bump it up to 20 or 30 this year as a senior. Didn't happen for him. Got off to really an atrocious start offensively, but it's, you know, he's come on of late. But this is, you know, the coming on of late is kind of probably the best you can expect at the pro level. He just doesn't have the high-end hockey offensive instincts and hands and skills to be a major point producer. But he's going to go in, he's going to muck in the corners, he's going to establish a good net front presence, he's got some grit to him, he's got a little dirty to him too. I mean, he kind of plays on the edge sometimes. And ultimately, you know, he'll chip in offensively, but they weren't getting him, you know, thinking, hey, look, you know, he's a future, you know, top liner for us. I don't think the Bruins had any illusions. He's a good, solid, serviceable prospect. He's going to need some time in the minors, but, you know, very well could play because he's got good wheels and good size. And so if nothing else, he can go in and throw a hit and kind of, you know, muck things up a bit. So that, by the way, CJ, I really like that husky in your avatar. That's a, you know, nice looking dog. We had a husky for 10 years and she was an awesome dog. So again, I appreciate the question there. Moving on to a question from Justin Walden, PhD, another person I've been corresponding with on Twitter for quite a few years now. He says, from what you've seen from USHL prospects, what's the most critical lesson that they get from playing in that league? That is a great question, Justin. Thanks for asking. I think the biggest thing with that league is just the maturity and the reality check that it provides kids. A lot of them will come in and they're just, it's such a bigger, stronger, faster league. It's the top junior league in the country, in the U.S. And, you know, whether you're an older guy who's finished high school and has to play some junior before a scholarship opens up for you at the D1 level, or you're a young prodigy like a Kiefer Bellows who comes in at 16 last year and just tears it up and helps his team to win a Clark Cup, or you're kind of in between, you're maybe a late bloomer and your skills taking a little longer to emerge. There's a little something for everyone in that league. And I think it forces guys to grow up. Some of the younger, less physically mature, they might have a lot of skill, but they haven't matured yet physically. Kind of opens their eyes up to what they're getting ready to face at the NCAA level. I'll talk about the National Team Development Program because I think it's been a stroke of genius that they moved to the USHL a few years back. They originally were in the NAHL, which is a lower level, but forcing the NTDP guys to play in the USHL and against D1 programs and against top international competition has resulted in what you see a lot now, especially last year when you had Jack Eichel, Noah Hanifin, Zach Werenski come out of the national team, go right to college and just have immediate impacts and play at such a high level. You know, as young 17-year-olds, you know, Eichel turned and Hanifin turned 18 during the course of the season. Werenski played the entire year as a 17-year-old freshman at Michigan last year. I mean, that's remarkable, but that's a reflection of the on and the off-ice work that they get at the national program, and then playing that USHL competition where they're going up against bigger, stronger guys and really, you know, having to kind of cut their teeth at that level and understand what they're in for. So It's I think it's a great league, and that helps them. And I think also the travel helps them as well, just kind of getting used to the pro style schedule. And sometimes we see a tendency with some of these NCAA players that are younger or playing, not younger, but they play in the fewer number of games like ECAC and things like that. They tend to hit that wall, that rookie wall, when they turn pro, just because they're not used to playing that many games. But I appreciate the question, Justin, and I hope that covered it for you. Question comes from Captain Jack 24. He asks, is Charlie McAvoy a good Bruins fit? I would say the answer to that question, Captain Jack, is yes. He is a very good defenseman, has looked very polished and poised as a freshman at Boston University. This is exactly what I was talking about on the previous question about the USHL. He's a product of the national team. He's another one of these players that came in at age 17 when he started, although he's already turned 18 since the season began. But he's a young freshman, probably could have certainly been still a senior in high school this year, but instead he's playing at a very high level in the NCAA. He doesn't have a lot of height, but he's thickly built, solid guy. He's able to kind of absorb hits and dish out some good physical play down low and along the walls. He's more of a riverboat gambler kind of defense. You can see him really push the pace and take the puck and go. Real good passer, has nice vision and sight lines and makes some creative plays. You're going to really see, I think, his offensive numbers take off going forward. But I like him. He'd be a good fit. He'd be a good fit for anyone, really. I think I like him in the bottom third of the first round. I know at Redline we have him a little lower than that, but certainly if McAvoy gets into the second round, he won't last but a couple of picks into the second round, because he's got some of that nice higher ceiling potential that teams are looking for. So I like him. Next question is from Boston Pucks, who says, will the CHL ever allow under 20s who've outgrown the league to play in the AHL, or are they just too greedy, a.k.a. Sinisha next year? the short answer to your question is no, but I wouldn't say it's because they're greedy. I would say because their system is set up to where if they were to allow the NHL teams to take their 18- and 19-year-old players that are drafted and put them in the AHL, their teams, their junior teams, just wouldn't be viable. A lot of these teams are the lifeblood of these smaller Canadian towns and cities that support them. And it's almost like a symbiotic relationship. And if you're just gutting the team every year because the NHL clubs come in and draft several of them, you're essentially, especially the good teams that will have multiple draft picks. I mean, imagine a team like the London Knights, for example, that are going to have probably four or five, maybe even six players drafted out of that club this year. Imagine if the NHL teams that drafted all those guys could just take them next year. I don't see it happening, and I don't think it's because of greed. I think in a perfect world, the NHL would figure out a way that teams could designate an exceptional talent status to one player and put them in the AHL, because it is tough. You know, you're either in the NHL at 18 or you got to go back to junior, but I think ultimately that's going to be tough to do as well, because it gets back to what I said using the London analogy. When you get these really good junior teams that build and amass talent and are real powerhouses, they would essentially be punished for being successful, because the NHL teams would draft their players and then take them away. And it's one thing if an NHL team grabs a guy and he's playing for the big club. It's another thing if they take him and he's down toiling around in the AHL and maybe things aren't going well and he's like a healthy scratch every night. So I understand the situation. I understand the frustration. In terms of Sinisian, using him as an example, I don't think that's a great example to use, Boston Pucks, just because, I mean, I've been studying him pretty well and talking to multiple people in the know. And, Sinisian, as good as he's been, he's got a lot to work on. He's still a pretty raw player. And I think He'll certainly benefit from another year of junior. It'll only be his third, unlike most of his peers who had 2 years in the OHL and then were drafted. He only had one. So he's got room for improvement. So I'm not sure he's the greatest example to use there in your question. But, hey, I understand where you're coming from and noted. I just don't think you're going to get any good news on that anytime soon. Next question comes from Mike Burns, who's another guy I've known for a while. We were on an old Boston Bruins mailing list, email list back in the day in the 90s. And, you know, he's a sharp guy, Stanford guy. And he and I have had some exchanges on Twitter that are interesting over the years. But he says, how do you go about projecting potential of no offense D prospects? And he says, for example, guys like Linus Arneson. That's a great question because it's tough. A player like Linus Arneson, it was a late second-round pick in 2013, and you would think he would be very high on the rankings, but he's really not because he's one of these players that just, when you look at the numbers and the production, it just isn't there. However, he's a fluid, mobile skater. He's got good size, and he really is a smart defenseman. But he's defensive in nature. You know, he's savvy positionally. He's got good stick positioning and he's strong in his gap control. He's still figuring things out. I mean, this has been good for him to transition to the smaller ice surfaces and figure some things out. It hasn't been complete smooth sailing. It's like not like Arneson showed up and he's just automatically, you know, logging top minutes and dominating defensively. But you can see why the Bruins liked him. On the downside, there's just not much there offensively for him. He doesn't lead the rush. He's not the kind of guy that's going to put defenses on their heels. Doesn't seem to have the vision or the hockey sense to really make long offensive plays that will lead to primary assists. And he's not a power play kind of guy who can run your power play from the point and really excel in puck distribution. He's just a solid defensive, mobile defender. He'll be good, I think, in puck retrieval and getting the puck out of the zone. But he'll essentially be more known on his half of the ice than anything else. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But it's tough to project him because he looks smooth. He looks good. But nothing screams at you that he's an exciting player and he's going to be something. He's going to develop into a top, you know, 1, 2, 3 type defender. He's probably going to be a solid 4 or 5, and there's nothing wrong with that. Every team needs guys like that, and you win with players like Arneson. But I think his statistics have certainly kind of shown what he's going to do. He's going to bring very little in terms of production. But you pair him with a good offensive-minded guy that maybe likes to gamble a little bit and roam and get up the ice, and Arneson will oftentimes find himself having to bail him out, and that's not a bad thing. So thanks for that, Mike. Hope falls well on your end. Dan D, Dirty Dan 97, asks, players the Bruins should target in the 12 to 22 range of the draft, where their San Jose picks likely end up. Wow. Hey, you don't have to prompt me to talk about the draft. I always enjoy that. So I think there are several options that they're potentially looking at. One player on defense I like a lot is Olli Juolevi. I don't know if he will kind of stay middle of the pack or he'll end up getting closer to the higher end of the draft, but he's a Finnish defenseman playing for London. He's just really smooth, good skater, long loping stride. He's a bit of a lanky beanpole, so he's got a lot of room to grow and fill out, but I like his game. He can really make the good passes. Good shot, not scoring a lot of goals, but you can see the potentials there as he gets more physically mature and stronger. He's going to add power to his drive. He's still figuring things out as well. The nuances of defense are lost on him in certain situations. He'll react a certain way, and I think that's a reflection of adjusting to the smaller ice surface and kind of figuring out how to play defense in North America. But I like him. Another player that I would certainly be intrigued if the Bruins were able to come away with him, and that's Kiefer Bellows. That's Brian Bellows' son. I talked about him at length on my draft podcast, but he's a kid that's headed to BU. Might not be a dynamic skater, but man, he just knows how to score. And he's a pure scorer and finisher, and I love the bloodlines and the fact he grew up around the game. He knows what it takes. Max Jones wouldn't be a bad choice for the Bruins. He's another London Knight, big American kid, can really skate. He's a guy that's kind of been on again, off again offensively. He may be more of a power forward who does the big hits and the dirty work, but doesn't necessarily generate a lot of points. But at the same time, he's made some plays this year that make you think, hey, maybe there's something more there to him. He's kind of where the NHL is going in terms of the way he motors up and down the wing, and, you know, initiate contact and fight for position, space in front of the net, and gets his stick on loose pucks and finishes off plays. I like him. Now, if you're going for some home run potential, I would really, you know, if the Bruins could somehow end up with Calgary hitman Jake Bean, this is a dynamic four-way compass skating defenseman who can just really push the pace, awesome power play ability, passer, shooter, just really is, you know, he doesn't have a lot of size. He's only about 6 foot, 175, so he might grow another inch, but he's going to have to add a lot of weight onto his frame. But this is an exciting puck-rushing defender who can do a little bit of everything. And I think he's pretty smart. I mean, his defense he's got to come along, but he's a right shot. And I think certainly he's going to bear some close scrutiny. We've got him pretty high at Redline. Western Canada is not my area, but our Western Canadian scouts really like him. And he just seems to fit the bill. Everything you want in a defenseman except for the average size, but I think he'll get a little bigger, and he won't be too undersized. He just won't be that bigger physical package that a Jacob Chychrun brings. So I think, you know, any of those guys would be a good option for the Bruins. Chris Abraham says buy or sell at the deadline. Keeper sign Louis. Should they make roster spots to see what Coco Griffith, etc., can do in the NHL? Well, I've kind of addressed some of those things in terms of Louis and making roster spots for the AHL guys earlier with Petrano. But Chris, what I'll tell you is I think they'll do both at the deadline. I think they're certainly probably going to sell Louis, see what they can get for him. It'll probably end up being futures or maybe either in the form of pick or maybe a prospect. I just don't know that they'll be able to get a whole lot for him because those high picks are so much more valuable because of the value of having those low cost controlled entry level contracts and key skill players that can come in and contribute on those ELCs rather than spend those ELCs in the minors. And it's anyone's guess, but I think they'll be looking to try to upgrade their defense in some way, shape, or form. I just don't know what that's going to look like, and I think fans will kind of have to steel themselves for a rather middling kind of return, and maybe we'll have to look to the summer when maybe Don Sweeney can continue to accrue assets and maybe make that move for the bigger splash at defense. Sports and stuff. Patrice Bergeron asked earlier today, when should we expect to see some of the D-men, Zboril, Carlo, etc., in Providence, then vying for a spot in Boston? Thanks for the question. I will just say, you know, I'm not big on timetables. That's not something that I'm, you know, usually very good at doing anyway. But I think we'll definitely see Carlo because he's on a club that's not doing so great. So when his season ends, we'll probably see him in Providence. We'll probably see Matt Grizzlick and Rob O'Gara at some point, depending on how long their seasons run into on the college side. The Bruins could, you know, don't necessarily have to sign them to an NHL deal right away. They could put them on a amateur tryout and put them in Providence. But I think we'll just have to see. As far as vying for a spot, I mean, we'll just have to see how they develop and who else the Bruins bring in. But, you know, I think there's a lot of reason for optimism at the defense position. I just don't really see anyone right now that's that top level, you know, number one, number two, high end. Elite defenseman. Someone might develop into that. That would certainly be great news for the Bruins organization. You can certainly make a lot of hay with the skill element of guys like Zboril and the shutdown aspect of a Brandon Carlo and a Rob O'Gara, and then the offensive instincts of a Matty Grizzlick, and then the kind of the blend between them all that you have with Jeremy Lazan. So I think and Linus Arneson as well as a mobile shutdown guy. So I think there's going to be some guys that are going to upgrade them eventually. I don't know when that would be, and we're just going to have to be patient and see it play out. The last question is by Central Scrutinizer, who's another guy that has kept up with me over the years, fellow fan of Frank Zappa. That's A plus in my book right there. But he asked probably the question of the 3 days, and that's why I saved it for last. And it said, if you can only keep one Bruins prospect at each position, who would they be? And then he clarifies, anybody in the system not currently with the Bees. And so, that's a tough one. I've gone through this several times, and I'll start with the goaltender because we're already approaching an hour in this podcast, and I'm not going to quite get under an hour, but I don't want it to go too far over. So I think a goalie, flip a coin between Malcolm Subban and Zane McIntyre, but I have a longer history, personal history with Zane and more of a body of work with him, and I've seen him at multiple levels. And you know, it's no slight on Malcolm Subban. I think he's a terrific young goaltender in person. Sky's the limit with him. But if I had to choose one, I just think there's more to Zane, and the best is yet to come. It's just going to take longer to tease it out of him, and so he's the guy I'm going with. At defense, this is tough. I think I'm caught between Brandon Carlo and Jeremy Lauzon right now. Carlo is such a good shutdown type prospect for the Bruins. I think he's going to, with his size and his mobility, he's going to play for a long time, but I'm not all that sold on his offense. This is where Jeremy Lauzon, who's not as capable a shutdown guy, but who kind of is more of a jack of all trades, well-rounded guy. He's just someone at this stage right now of their development, all things being equal, I would take Lauzon over Carlo. And so I'm taking him. And then if I had to take a second defenseman, it's tough. But again, you need those guys that can push the pace, carry the offense, do a lot of things, and then have the character. And I think nobody embodies that more than Matty Grizzlick. We've seen Torrey Krug at times be a mail carrier for this team and more recently struggle. But so there's always that risk when you have the more undersized defenseman. But I just have been watching Grizzlick for so long and just seen him come so far. So I think I would stick with Lauzon and Grizzlick at D. Up on the forwards, left wing, Frank Vetrano obviously comes to mind. But boy, Jesse Gabriel sure is having a heck of a season for Prince George. 35 goals, 65 points. He hits, he fights, he agitates. We've seen how important Brad Marchand is to the Boston Bruins' fortunes. Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not big on comparing people, but Gabriel, he looks up to Marchand and tries to pattern his game after Marchand. So I'm going to take that caveat and say you can never have too many guys like that. Gabriel obviously has some physical maturing to do, and he needs to make sure he reins in his emotions. But I'd look at keeping him. At center, you've got Jacob Forsbacka Carlson. Certainly, Ryan Donato is someone who comes to mind as well. In the end, I like JFK and what he's bringing to the mix as a poised freshman. People look at him and they're like, there's not a wow factor there, but you don't necessarily need a wow factor. Sometimes guys just get it, and they can find ways to make things happen in so many ways. I mean, did Patrice Bergeron really have that much of a wow factor? I don't think so, and he's become one of the most dependable players. So I like JFK. And then finally on the right wing, right now Danton Heinen's playing the right wing in the Pacific Rim Line and Denver University, and then, of course, Zach Senishin. It's a tough call. Got to go with Zach Senishin. I don't see too many people just continue to beat the D with speed to the outside the way he does, works hard, goes to the net. He's still a work in progress, a lot of improvement, but man, 33 goals is 33 goals. And right now he and Gabriel have accounted for 68 goals from the left and the right side in Major Junior. And there's no combo on any team that can boast that same amount of production. So those are the guys I'm going with. Great question, Central Scrutinizer. Again, everyone, thank you for bearing with me. This podcast ran a bit long, but I hope you enjoyed the questions and the answers, and I look forward to doing this again. And if you bailed out a while ago, then I guess you're not hearing this. So on that note, I'm going to sign off. But again, Thanks for the support. Continue to check in on the Scouting Post. I'll have more features. I'm going to be working on some new projects, including a Case 4 series, resurrecting something I did for my old Bruins 2011 Draft Watch, where I actually made a case for certain players. As the draft comes more into focus and the Bruins draft positions and rankings kind of start to bear out, I'm going to argue and make cases for certain players. So I hope you'll check in on that. And again, you can follow me on Twitter at kludeke29. And if you ever have any questions, just fire my way. Thanks to everyone that submitted the questions. Again, have a great President's Day and all the best to you. Take care.